from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll get a preview of the Julian Center's Julian Jam coming up later this month.
I'll get a preview of Theater on the Square's production of Enter Love.
And I'll learn about how a psychology book gets made into an opera. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The Julian Center supports victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and other life crises, and the Julian Jam supports the Julian Center. The Jam takes place at the Sky Farm on top of Eskenazi Hospital on Wednesday, August 26th. Travis DiNicola spoke with WFYI's own Stephen Stolen, who is the Senior Director of External Relations for the Julian Center. Joining them is Michael Huber, who, among other things, is part of the indie chamber R&B band Chamber Music, who will be featured at the Jam.
Stephen, Michael, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you guys here.
It is. Thank you, Travis.
Stephen, this is fun for me. I mean, obviously, many people know your voice from Stolen Moments and all the other things.
Hi
that
there,
you
and good evening.
To do. There you go.
Or good morning.
This is, though, the first time I've had a chance to really chat with you about your new gig at the Julian Center. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about the Julian Jam in just a minute, which is going to be an awesome evening. But you've been at the Julian Center now for...
Since the beginning of the year.
Okay.
So 7 months, 7.5 months.
Tell me about your role there and what the Julian Center does, which is great work.
Yeah, the Julian Center is 40 years old. It's the leading organization to... in the sector of domestic and sexual violence here in, in central Indiana, and really in Indiana in very much a regional way. We get calls from all over the country virtually every day to tackle the ever-growing and ever more aware issue of domestic violence in our community. And my job is to really help elevate the organization so that it has more community prominence and actually help ready it and its leadership and its staff and all the folks involved there for the Julian Center's next iteration. It's, as I said, 40 years old. It's a well-known organization throughout the country in this sector, but you know, like many organizations, perhaps not as well-known in its own hometown as is. And so that's part of my job. And, of course, the inevitable, you know, try to raise more funds, try to create more resources, try to create more opportunities for people to get involved with really now what used to be, you know, a kind of in the shadows organization, now an essential front and center organization. We read about domestic violence in the newspaper or on the web every
unfortunately,
day. Unfortunately, every day. Yeah. And we have to understand that this isn't just about any segment of the population, that it's everywhere. It's in every neighborhood, in every cul-de-sac. It's in rural communities. And so there's a lot of work to be done. It's really good work. There's extraordinary people doing this work and sort of wrapping their arms around residents and clients and, yes, victims and their children every day.
And that's a big part of what the Julian Center does is provide that counseling and support, but also provides housing, provides a safe place for people getting out of abusive relationships and for their kids.
Yeah, and, you know, I think for years it's been described as a shelter. Mm-hmm. And part of what I do is help create a vocabulary that can describe us, I would say, better. And we're not just a shelter. We are an organization that shelters. A shelter is a verb. And sheltering is all of that spectrum and that continuum of care that happens from the time someone comes to the center, whether they need to be in the center or in the shelter, or they're there for help, or they're there for a referral, or they're there for counseling, or frankly, they just need some place to sort of have time to figure things out. And that's what the great people at the Julian Center do.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys are kind of almost always packed, right?
We're full. There used to be an ebb and flow, Travis. There used to be times of the season and times of year and various times, in fact, unpredictable as to when there would be space at the Julian Center. Now we're full all the time. Today I learned there are people sleeping on couches in the library.
Wow.
There are more people in a room than really we would like.
Yeah.
But the shelters, not only our shelter, but all the shelters are full. So the need is acute. the work is awesome and the people are great. And that's both the residents and the kids and mostly moms, although we do serve men as well.
Mm-hmm. Where's most of the support come from for the work that you do?
It's really kind of divided into thirds. A third of it passes through government funding, mostly mm-hmm. the Department of Justice, another third through sort of foundation support, and the sure. other third through generous people in the community wanting to help us with financial contributions. I always say, you know, there's never enough money. So yep. everything helps, and it's a little like our enterprise, you know, in radio, mm-hmm. although we're saving people's lives down the street. But yeah. There's never enough money, so you can't worry about that. You just try to get as many people involved, and you try and uplift the message, because this is not about an ice pack and a bowl of soup and a locked door. It's about the joyful outcomes when folks get their lives put back together and they can go out in the community and really be residents of Indianapolis confidently and contribute and be part of, you know, the community that we all enjoy.
Well, there's certainly a need, and the Julian Jam is going to help with that need. Before we get into that, one quick question for you, Stephen. For people who are looking for services from the Julian Center, mm-hmm. what's the best way for them to get a hold of
Dial
the center?
Dial 211.
211.
Which is a terrific program, buoyed by additional state funding this year. We're very proud of that. If you call 211, explain the problem, the situation, even in code, they'll figure it out and they'll get you to either our door or the right door that will help you right now. So it's just 211.
Excellent.
Simple.
Michael, so you are full-time a rock star and freelancing, part-time, little gig you do with the Indy Chamber of Commerce, CEO. Is that the exact title?
That is my day job.
Yes. Yeah. That is your real day
great.
Job.
Yeah. No, a lot of, I guess it'll be 2 years in September, a lot of changes happening, but it's been great so far, enjoying its 125th year, mm-hmm. and you know, we do a lot of things. We're a network of businesses. We advocate, and we also have been we're growing our economic development programs and services. So it's a really exciting time, and it's obviously the competitiveness among regions in America and mm-hmm. around the world is changing, and so our tools are changing. So it's been a great couple of years.
That's
and
awesome.
We're going to continue to go through a lot of changes.
Very good, very good. Well, I mean, doing great work here in the city, promoting the
Thank
city,
you.
Growing the city, working with businesses. Obviously, Julian Center is something that's important to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so some of it is just living in Fall Creek, place where we live, and being just a few blocks away from the facility on Meridian Street. But absolutely. I mean, they're the premier, you know, institution service provider for people who are going through some real life challenges. We've always appreciated how accessible they are.
Mm-hmm.
Known people who have referred and been referred to their services, and so I mean, all Stephen had to say is, you know, Julian Center, music. You know, Eskenazi Hospital, this combination of things. I was like, okay, I don't need to know the details. Yeah.
Okay, so chamber music. This is great. This is the band that you've put together, right?
Kind of. So
tell me, I mean, obviously it's some of this relates to chamber.
Some of this relates to Stephen Stolen, honestly, yeah. because he's done a lot of different things career-wise, you know, the IRT and mm-hmm. helping to lead other educational and cultural institutions. And I always admired he's always able to integrate his musical life and, you know, Stolen Moments and his singing into kind of seamlessly with his work. And so I, you know, until recently, it's not that I was embarrassed about my musical life. I think, mm-hmm. you know, I didn't want to, you know, when you're one of the younger people at work, you don't want to seem frivolous and things like that. And so Stephen and other friends that I had in recent years have basically said, get over yourself,
yeah.
right? And so it just turned
out. He's a
pretty
good role model.
Yeah, yeah. And it turned out
an old guy,
but it turns out that yeah. So music is a huge part of my life as a you know church musician and in different bands. But I have I discovered I had a bunch of really amazing musicians who worked for the chamber,
yeah.
like five at the time. And so it's a group of nine people.
Uh-huh.
I guess officially five are chamber employees, two are family members of
mm-hmm.
people who work for the chamber, and there are two additional musicians who are related to the chamber that we were able to recruit. Three of the band of my bandmates were alums of the Indiana University Soul Review, this elite
okay.
group, and it's just been too much fun. We got together early on, really at the urging of one of our lead singers. His name's Brady Jacoba, and he said, "Think about it. We've got a complement of musicians here. We're going to do this,
mm-hmm.
and we are not we're not officially part of the Indie Chamber, but sure. we've played Indie Chamber events, and we play classic soul and R&B, so things that people would know. Sometimes the arrangements will change,
mm-hmm.
but that kind of music has a real generational appeal.
It's always fun stuff.
Yeah. And so it's been great, but to do it with a group of musicians who are really good. So on one hand, we're not, you know, high art, you know, playing mm-hmm. original music. But on the other hand, we'd want people to know it's a lot better than kind of a garage band. Well, I mean, we're paying homage to a lot of our favorite, R&B and soul
sure.
artists. So it sounds like a terrible
idea.
So
you're having
idea.
Fun, but you're also doing it for a good cause, because most of the gigs you play, if they're not chamber events, aren't they related to not-for-profits
yeah,
and other things?
They've been benefits yeah. for causes we believe in. Of course, we're always open to play, you know the occasional corporate gig or wedding mm-hmm. or things like that. But that was also a part of it, too, is maybe yeah. this is a way that we can contribute and change the context and help organizations that we really want to support. So it's been so much fun.
That's really cool.
And part of what we said before was, you know, the Julian Center's, one of the things, you know, I require a sense of humor to have any kind of success. And Michael and I have spent much more time talking about music in our friendship than almost anything. And talking about fun and having fun and in an incredibly great place. The synergies here are so awesome. And we all care about the same thing. Someone said, well, you know, what are you going to talk about? I'm like, well, we all care about the same thing. Just, you know, the first Julian Jam this year was at WFYI.
Mm-hmm.
And we had Sarah Grain, Billions of Stars. And we did it in the Rubin Room, which is we have a building named after the Rubin family as well. And so this idea of creating community, then having this good time. And Michael, you know, soft pedals, to use a musical term, his musical skill. But Michael knows his way around music really, really well. And so it's all high quality stuff with high quality people for high quality causes, and it's I hope irresistible.
This particular event is just going to be awesome. I mean, excuse me for interrupting, but I mean, you know, having it be a benefit for Julian Center, having chamber music there, but as you know, we talked about just briefly, it's at the Skyform at Eskenazi. It's mm-hmm. it's on the roof, which is such an amazing, gorgeous space. Mm-hmm. You know, for anyone who's been up there, they know what I'm talking about. If you haven't been up there, it's an incredible view. There's gardens. There's places to
Nothing
walk
like
around.
It.
There
Nothing
really
like
isn't.
It.
And, you know, and to have an event up there with you guys playing, and I believe you were saying you're the first band to actually play up there for an event like this, which is pretty cool. So
we're
going to
say we
you know,
are.
We, let's go ahead and do that. I mean, what a great combination. So, you know, and of course, the evening there'll be drinks and some food and all that sort
all
of
that
stuff.
All that included. So that makes it a real bargain.
Which is really nice. And, of course, it all benefits Julian Center. What a fun idea. I mean,
Thanks.
Great partnerships, too, to get together with Eskenazi as well.
It's never a bad idea, Travis, to hang around with musicians, you know. I always say, you know, I do that other little thing here
it's
at
WFYI. It's not what my mom said, but...
Well, you know, usually it's worked out okay for me. Mm-hmm. But it's never a bad idea to go listen to some music or turn on the radio and listen to some music. It's never a waste of time.
No, not at all, especially for a good cause. I mean, this sounds really fun. Michael, I'm sorry, you were about to say something.
No, it was about the space and you know, if your listeners are interested, and we hope they will, join us at 9 and support the Julian Center. The you know, Eskenazi Hospital has just put this city on another, threshold, another level, just in terms mm-hmm. of it. Just the idea that our public hospital, who serves all, can be have world class design, integrate sustainability, and all those things,
a
come together at the Sky
Farm.
So,
other concerts
exactly.
that they do as part. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, just in the past 2 years or so, how many times? I've done interviews where Eskenazi comes up with different artists, whether visual artists or musicians, designers, poets who are working on projects there as well, which is great that's part of our public hospital.
It's all part of their belief, actually. That's all part of healing.
Yeah.
And healing also for people who are there who need to be healed, but for a community that just can go to a hospital of all places and have these great sense of place, great, beautiful places, really beautiful places, with an incredible sense of hospitality, which speaks to, you know, everything we believe about ourselves in Indianapolis, and then have fun and have music and really high-quality stuff. You know, Lisa Harris and Matt Gutwein, mm-hmm. Ernie Vargo, they championed this idea, too.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, it was their idea. They knew I wanted to do something. They said, let's do it here.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're, you know, sponsoring and helping us host it. And so it is special, and it is, you know, it's not going to happen all the time. So we hope folks will come out, support the Julian Center, enjoy Michael's band, meet some of our folks, hear a little bit more. We'll have some storytelling about the Julian Center. But mostly it's there to really celebrate good work with good folks in a good city.
And did I mention it's a great view up there?
Yeah.
It is such
a
cool space.
Pretty great
space. So $50 a ticket, four for $150. So really good deal. Again, all that going to support the Julian Center, mm-hmm. but drinks and food, good concert, good night. Yeah. It's going to be a lot of fun.
I hope so. We think so.
Yeah, very cool. I want to ask you, Stephen, the Julian Jam on the flyer that I've seen for this, it says an occasional concert series.
Right.
You mentioned one before. You're looking at doing more of these, it sounds
like. Yeah, we used to do one a year for a great big crowd.
Yeah.
And what I felt like as a musician is that didn't really give the music a chance to really be important. And it also didn't give folks a chance to really kind of be together and have mm-hmm. that sense of community, which is one of the things that we do well at
yeah.
the Julian Center. And so having more frequent events gives the staff and the folks of the Julian Center a chance to know more people, to get to know more people,
sure.
to share experiences and the good news of what's going on, and be in different places. So we did one here, you know, in the mm-hmm. community room. We did one at the Arts Center with Sweet Poison Victim and Whip
oh,
Stitch
yeah.
Sally's. Man,
mm-hmm.
well, that was something else. And so we want to do them in some kind of surprising places with and have a really great local feel, maybe not all the time, but
mm-hmm.
really have really great high-quality stuff going. So, yes, and the occasional Travis gives me room to say, I don't know when the next one
yeah,
is.
Yeah, whatever the next
pay,
one is.
But pay attention.
That seems to be, so now I'm putting my chamber hat on.
Go right
it
ahead.
Seems to be, you know, in today's world where everybody's very connected but nobody has enough time, you know, changing the context because we're trying to do it at, you know, business and economic development related
mm-hmm.
events as well. We're doing a lot more with cultural institutions and partnering because people don't want to go to a stuffy boardroom anymore, you know,
yeah.
for those
mm-hmm.
kinds of things. And so that's, again, one thing. If you've followed Stephen's career at various, you know, institutions and helping give them a, you know, a real shot in the arm, changing that context is something that he does. And you know, it's definitely influenced me in terms of the types of events and ways that we bring people together at the chamber. So it'll be fun.
Awesome.
We will.
Gentlemen, thank you both for coming in to Art of the Matter today. Pleasure to see you both. It's going to be a great night for Julian Jam.
Thanks, Travis.
Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with Stephen Stolen of the Julian Center and Michael Huber, CEO of the Indy Chamber of Commerce. The Julian Jam takes place at the Sky Farm on top of the Eskenazi Hospital on Wednesday, August 26th. More information can be found at juliancenter.org, juliancenter.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Airports are a metaphor for love's arrivals, departures, delays, and cancellations. And this fall, Theater on the Square will open its season with Enter Love, a musical love story complete with symbolic rough landings and some baggage. Indianapolis composer and Enter Love creator Lynn Leupold, director and book co-writer Kenny Shepard, and actor Clay Mabbitt landed in the studio with Sharon Gamble for this interview.
So, Lynn and Kenny, have you worked together before this project?
Well, not exactly together. We'd kind of started coming together after we had the first run of Enter Love, which was a cabaret show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I first met Kenny and asked him if he might be interested after we had put a script together. And he said, foolishly, yes, I would. So we've been together now for five shows, I guess.
I saw the cabaret and then I was, oh, to be very polite, I was drafted to to help choreograph and direct Enter Love. It actually, it went from a cabaret to an actual musical theater piece. We added a script. So that's when I came on board.
Which is a big change.
A huge change, yeah. A lot of storytelling developed in that amount of time.
So, Lynn, take me back to the germ of the idea. Where did you get the idea?
I wanted to put a show together of my music, mm-hmm. and Shannon Forsell was gracious enough to allow me to put a cast together of four people and run it at the cabaret for several performances. And at that one of the performances, one of the gentlemen that happened to be there came up afterwards and he said, have you ever considered putting a script with all of this music? And I said, no, but if you'd like to take a shot at it, go ahead.
Okay.
And so he actually came up with the idea of developing a storyline that was based on being in an airport and how relationships between people might exist. And many of the songs that I had written were very connected to relationships. And so his name is Don Siebold, and he is actually was sort of the beginning of thinking about what this could all look like.
Okay. When you started to string songs together to put them in an order for the cabaret, what was your organizing principle?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure that in the very beginning we knew what it was going to be. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of songs that sort of would lend themselves to an opener or a closer.
Sure.
And then as the characters began to develop, we sort of began to connect some of the songs with those characters. That has changed, and it has sort of evolved over the last few years. Every time we've done the show, we've made some little tweaks here and there, and sometimes we've taken characters out, put new ones in. Sometimes we've done the same thing with songs. So we've tried to stay true to the script that has been revised and rewritten so that that continues to move forward with the music.
Kenny, you said you were drafted, but you said it with a twinkle in your eye that tells me that you didn't mind being drafted. What was enticing to you about this project?
Well, it was exciting to me that I could have some freedom to help with the script. Don, as Lynn mentioned, had this really clever idea of setting it in an airport. Since that original idea, we've added a storm, which has been kind of a cool element, mm-hmm. because when people are forced to stay in an airport for a longer amount of time than they had planned, they really start to open up to the person sitting next to them on the bar stool, the person next to them on the plane. When you think you're going to be there for 10 minutes at the bar and it turns into 4 hours, then you really start to share and open up your life. So we added that storm element. But originally, it was exciting to me that I could be part of that team that could help tweak the script, edit the script, and also direct and choreograph. So it really was all-encompassing, and it was a lot of fun to be that involved in something from the beginning.
You have 10 actors.
Yes.
How many characters?
We have 16 characters in this version.
Wow.
And the fun thing for me is that we actually, there's a little bit of a campy element involved. It's really lighthearted, a fun approach. So some of the characters actually use their carry-on luggage. They'll open them up and use costumes within their carry-on in front of the audience and change characters in front of the audience. So we make no pretense about trying to hide the fact that the actors, who are very talented, are playing multiple roles.
Sure. Well,
and in this one production that we're doing now, Kenny has actually combined two characters into one person. Who played?
Well, it's actually husband and wife.
It's a husband and wife, mm-hmm. and so it's one person who plays both of those parts. So that's going to be an interesting.
So you get to see both sides of the relationship.
Yes, exactly.
Love it.
They're always searching for each other. Obviously,
in some mythologies, the two halves that are split apart, and they keep trying to get back together. That makes perfect sense. Clay, are you one of the people playing multiple characters?
I do. I play a bankruptcy lawyer who fancies himself a little bit of a womanizer. And then I also play a more comedic role. We have a couple. Maybe the best word to use is redneck, but the most cartoonish version of that would still be real, I guess, for a comic number. So I get to do both of those, and that is a lot of fun.
Those are completely different character types.
Yes, they are.
how quick is the changeover from one to another? Is something else going on elsewhere on stage so you can catch your breath and go, okay, now I'm this completely different person?
I don't think I'll be talking while changing clothes. I don't have to shift my voice between one character and the other as I'm dressing. But it's not slow. But We'll see how those pieces all fit together.
He doesn't know the answer to that yet. He's right.
I should point out, as we're having this conversation, you're in the early swing of rehearsing. So this will be tracked, or will you have piano? Or
we'll have a live orchestra. We'll actually have six pieces, three keyboards, a bass player, a drummer. And we wanted to use live music for lots of reasons. We think it's the most authentic sound. We have used tracks before for some of our other productions, but in this particular case, we wanted to stick with a live group.
Little Bird told me that a group was looking in the off-site storage of the theater's shop and found airport seats? Is that
airplane
true?
Seats, yes.
Airplane seats?
Absolutely. In fact, when we did this production in Lafayette, one of the cast members Kenny had mentioned something about it'd be great if we had airplane seats, and she said, oh, we've got some in our garage, which I don't know why it has some. So
We didn't ask.
But anyway, so we got to use them there, and when we went to Theater on the Square, Lori had told us that she thought they had some, and we scrounged around behind the set, and sure enough, there were three seats. So
it's a little disturbing to me, the number of people who happen to have airline seats lying
around. How did they get them? We don't ask.
Yeah, don't ask, don't tell, right? So how else are you suggesting the setting of the airport?
Well, the airport really centers around a bar. So Alex, the bartender, sort of serves as the psychiatrist to all the people coming in, telling uh-huh. them her problems. She also is having an affair with a pilot in the script. So she has her own arc to her own storyline.
Is that a little bit of a secret?
No, that's actually the first thing you learn in the okay. very first few seconds of the show. You learn that. There are other secrets, however, but that is not one of them. So you see the bar. That's kind of the focal point of the set. And then there's another level where you can actually walk up and board the plane. There's an observation deck. So we have a few zones within the bar that represent the airport.
And that gives you some creative resources for stage movement and choreography, too,
yeah,
right?
That's really my forte is staging. That's what I like to do the most is choreography and staging. So it's exciting to me. Those who know that space at TOTS, it's long and lean.
It is.
So we have a fantastic designer, Peggy Smith, who has created this beautiful airport setting with all of those zones. So,
what's the hardest thing about corralling and herding this many actors playing?
playing
this many different characters.
Well, we're very, very blessed to have the cream of the crop cast. And Lynn and I and Clay recruited people that we love. We love them in many ways, on and off stage. The problem with that is that talented people are very, very busy people. Mm. So just getting a rehearsal schedule together is the nicest way I can say it is it's not my favorite part of the process. But what we have
Please
one.
Tell me you can get all 10 actors together before opening night.
Oh, but yes.
A few times.
Twice, clearly.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Barely.
With the instrumentalist.
Right,
yes.
So these characters, it sounds like they range kind of broadly in age, right? Do we have some first love characters, some young love characters?
Yeah, we have a young couple. She is actually deploying off to serve her commitment with the National Guard and leaves her boyfriend at home, which is a little twist. So they're a young couple. The other couple that we mentioned, the gentleman plays both the wife and the husband. Mm-hmm. They're an older couple, kind of small town, and their horizons become broadened by meeting these characters at the airport. And then we have some in their 20s and 30s as well. We have a lesbian couple. We have a young father who is terrified of flying, but he has to do that to provide for his family. Mm. So there are some pretty fun characters. And the exciting thing for me in revamping the script is I feel like they're talking about things that people are talking about today at the airport. We talk about gay marriage. We talk about the freedom of religion. We talk about Caitlyn Jenner. The exact same things I think you would hear if you were stuck in an airport for 4 or 5 hours and were brave enough to kind of broach some of those topics.
Isn't that called, I don't know why I was thinking about this recently, isn't that called a bus stop play where people are retained for
yes.
reasons outside of their control?
Right.
You know, a snowstorm.
Exactly.
Sticks them at a bus stop.
And amazingly, just as their stories get a resolution, oh, the storm is clearing and off,
I'm shocked.
Off we go.
I'm shocked to discover that.
The clouds part.
Lynn, I know, I know this will be hard for all of you to answer, but what's your favorite moment in the show? Do you have a favorite moment?
I have several favorite moments, and I guess part of them are related to the music. Obviously, I have some favorites that I prefer over some of the others. I really like the opening number that the cast does because it's all of the cast. They're very busy on stage. It's very exciting to see what's happening. And I also like the finale, the very last number that we're doing, which is called One Dream. And it's exciting because it sort of does the same thing in reverse of what the opening number did.
Huh.
And you do get to see the characters all come together again. And there are probably other moments in between that are fun to watch. And as a composer, the most exciting is to hear your music. So I'd have to say any of the music sounds
absolutely
be a highlight for me. But I also think I like how Kenny has done such a wonderful job of pulling this, whatever the cast is, whoever the cast might be, into this world that just seems to thrive. And he does a beautiful job of staging it, and it makes a difference. It doesn't make a difference whether you have a cast in Chicago or Lafayette or Indianapolis. It appears that he's clearly an expert at what he's doing, and I really appreciate that.
Favorite moment, Kenny?
Well, I have to agree with Lynn. I like I like the opening. It's called Babbling Voices. I think we have a track of that. And you really see everyone coming together and not knowing anybody else. And then by the end of the show, in contrast in the finale, One Dream, you see how the relationships have evolved, how they know each other. And many of the 10 characters who are represented at the end have a little more peace of mind. They've made some decisions over the course of this hour and a half or so. And you see the weight being lifted or a new light bulb moment over their head. So I like that this really talented cast is able to tell their story in a fast and efficient way.
And Clay, a favorite moment?
Yeah, I have viewing this through the lens of an actor who's playing these characters. There's a great moment. I have a character that is, he's this, I think I described him as a bankruptcy lawyer who fancies himself a womanizer. He is, it would be very easy to go down the path of making this a two-dimensional character and making some assumptions about how he would react to some of the other characters. I have this great moment. There's another character played by a wonderful actor, Danny Kingston. That character is gay. And it would be very easy for the script to be written so that my character has some problem with him being gay, but we didn't do that. You know, we took it in a different direction. There's other things that these two characters talk about, and at no point is my guy even fazed that he's talking to a gay man. They're just talking about fear of flying and drinking and family commitments and work stress, and they're just humans. And so, and that's reflective of what happens with a lot of the relationships in this show. It's getting through all that surface stuff and just finding out we're all people, we're all connected, you know, on all these different types of love and different types of relationships.
Sharon Gamble with Enter Love, creator Lynn Leupold, director and book co-writer Kenny Shepherd, and actor Clay Mabbitt. Enter Love opens the season for Theater on the Square and runs September 11th through the 27th. Find out more at tots.org, that's T-O-T-S.org. Let's listen to an excerpt from Babbling Voices, one of the tunes from the show.
Hey, Travis, we had so much fun with our interviews this week that there's almost no time for our calendar that we call.
What do we do?
What do you have? Very
well,
fast.
You know what? It's Fringe Weekend. It's opening this weekend. 384 shows all on Mass Avenue Live Theater Festival. It's a lot of fun. That's what I'm doing all weekend. Indie Fringe.
Absolutely. IndieFringe.org. You can plan your schedule and plan your attack. And don't forget, you can learn more about local arts events at IndieArts.org/guide. The Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide. We'll be back next week with a little bit longer version of What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Oliver Sacks' book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, may seem an unlikely source of inspiration for an opera, which is exactly why Travis DiNicola wanted to find out more. He spoke with the Indianapolis Opera's general director, Kevin Patterson, as well as stage directors Vita Tsikun and David Adam Moore of the New York-based art collective Glimmer.
Kevin, David, Vita, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have all of you here today.
Hi, thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to be here.
Excellent. And Kevin, welcome. You've
thank
been
you.
In Indianapolis now, what, about 6 months?
Well, with Indianapolis Opera since the 1st of February, okay. But back in Indianapolis after a 12-year absence last August. So
awesome. Well, welcome back.
Yeah, it's good to be
by
home.
By way of, Austin and Anchorage?
Yes. The long, circuitous path that started in 2002 with Pittsburgh Opera, then okay. on to Austin Lyric Opera, and then most recently up on the moon in Anchorage, Alaska.
Very cool. Well, I am really excited about the opera that's coming up, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, and I can't wait to hear how this book gets turned into an opera. But before we jump into all that, how are things at the opera? Because, knows that the opera in general has had a difficult time in the United States, and Indianapolis Opera has had its struggles, but I know has been also been doing a great job of rebounding and continuing to be sustainable. So tell me how that's going.
Well, Indianapolis Opera, and to your point, like most opera companies and arts organizations in the United States, have had to sort of reinvent themselves. There's a tremendous amount of innovation going on in the industry. It's interesting that as arts organizations, we're perceived by the public as being the most creative, the most innovative. But yet in my career, what I've learned is though we are capable of doing that, we're mm-hmm. also organizations who are sometimes the most change-averse people on the planet. And so we move at a glacial pace.
Sure.
So yes, Indianapolis Opera certainly has gone through its ups and downs, just like a lot of other opera companies in the United States. But we're back with this new season. We are back with a mission that I think is much more focused on three things: the voice and the ability for the voice to be able to tell stories in a way that no other art form can.
Mm-hmm.
We're back in that through using the voice and being on stage. That's a forum that we can use in our community to have a dialogue. We're not just doing pieces for the sake of doing pieces. I mean,
sure.
Sometimes that's fun. I love The Barber of Seville. I love Carmen. I love all mm-hmm. those pieces. But our ability to be able to be a catalyst for dialogue, and I think that The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat does that exceptionally well. That's what this opera is about. And then finally, you know, I have always been a firm believer through my education in Indiana University at the School of Music and other places that our art form is a catalyst to tell stories,
mm-hmm.
and that fundamentally as human beings, we like a good story.
Yeah.
And so Indianapolis Opera, as we move forward into this season, into future seasons, we're interested in those things, the voice, engaging the community, and telling a great story.
Well, one thing, I mean, you often hear about opera as it being one of the most expensive of the performing arts, and certainly traditional opera is, and that many opera companies are trying to do sort of non-traditional opera and make some changes. And it would seem to me The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat is pretty non-traditional.
Well, yes, I think it is. It's non-traditional in a sense that the way in which you produce it has to be approached in a completely different way. And
mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, as we get to talk to Vita and David, they're going to talk about their process and what they have done to achieve this production.
Okay.
It is a completely different production style. Certainly moving out of Clues Hall and mm-hmm. into the Schrott Center for the Arts.
Sure.
415 seats in the
Schrott.
A little
bit more intimate.
Much, much more intimate. Much closer to what you experience when you go to a European opera house.
Okay.
You know, even when we think of European opera houses, you know, the mind immediately jumps to La Scala or Covent Garden or some of the big
sure.
houses. But the majority of opera that's done throughout Europe is done in spaces that are much, much smaller in the 300 to 400 to 500 to 600 seat range. And that's where you really get to experience the intimacy of the art form.
Great for the audiences.
Great
and
for the audiences.
Less intimidating.
Yeah, it's less intimidating. And it also, I think it's a catalyst for driving the pieces home to the audience. You're
yeah.
not so distant from the experience. It's not washing over you. You now become a part of it.
Very cool. So Oliver Sacks, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. I mean, many people have read this book or excerpts from it or Oliver Sacks' other works, whether it's in New York or other places. And the basic premise is that, and this is a true story of a patient of Oliver Sacks, who essentially could not recognize shapes and objects anymore specifically. He would see them, but they wouldn't really register in his brain as, this is my wife, or this is a hat, or whatever it may be. Is that a fair analysis?
That is a fair analysis.
Yeah.
The character suffers from something called visual agnosia, and it is something that actually Oliver Sacks shares with this character. The character in the title, he has developed this over time.
Mm-hmm.
It is something that has been condition driven. He suffers from diabetes. He has been an opera singer in opera houses throughout the world. He and his wife fled Europe, came to America, has been teaching music, and over time he develops this condition.
Okay.
And just as in the story that Oliver Sacks writes about, it's not about dealing with the deficit that this man is dealing with. It's about dealing with the narrative of who this person is as a human being and how through dealing through this with this condition, their humanity still works through the condition and they are able to express themselves. And in the case of this character, Dr. P, mm-hmm. he is able to have a full and normal life, so much so that at the very beginning, at the first encounter with Dr. Sacks in the first scene, he shows up to the examination room and says, well, you know, there's really nothing wrong with me. I've had, you know, eye examinations. They say my eyesight's fine. Everything's fine. And even by the end of the first scene, Dr. Sacks is sort of left scratching his head going, wait a minute, was this an elaborate ruse? Was I put on here? Yeah. And it kind of makes him angry. And it's not until we move to the world in which Dr. P lives, his apartment, and get to learn about the human being in their own environment that Sacks, like the many of the stories in the book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, really goes to the humanity of this person, the human being, and how he expresses himself in his environment. And that's what makes this such an important piece, because in this day and age, many of us in our community deal with mental illness, mm-hmm. deal with neurological conditions. And so this is a piece that hits home and resonates because sure. people can look up on stage and identify with that character, the character's caregiver, his wife, and also Dr. Sacks in how they are all reacting and interrelating with each other.
Let me turn it to David and Vita here because I'm really curious. I mean, so much of the story is about the imagined visual element. I mean, you know, you can't hear it without thinking, what would that be like? And I'm just sort of guessing here that was sort of part of your work in the problem solving of doing the stage design for this. And I want to get to that in a second, but let me backtrack a little bit. You two are part of an artist collective, a group called Glimmer out of New York.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that, because I think that's really important to understand and how that connects with the opera here.
So, mm-hmm. yeah, Glimmer came about because we really love collaboration and we don't necessarily believe in borders between different disciplines. Both David and I are creative in many different ways. I design sets and costumes for both stage and film,
mm-hmm.
But I also do illustration and graphic design and painting and et cetera. And David is a professional opera singer, internationally known opera singer, and he also is a video artist and a photographer and a composer, video artist, and we collaborate in a very seamless way where we come up with ideas together, and sometimes David would come up with scenic ideas that I would then execute, or I might come up with video ideas that then he would execute.
Okay.
And so Glimmer was an envelope under which we can work, an umbrella, if you wish.
Sure.
And it's a collective into which we also invite a lot of other artists, like photographers and cinematographers, dancers, singers, whoever might want to contribute to a particular project. So David and I are founding members of this collective, and then we have a lot of other artists
Excellent.
Who come in.
And this is your first time working with Indianapolis Opera, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
That's correct.
Very. Now, have that's you worked right. on this particular opera in other places before?
Or? No. So this is our first
new.
Time with the show. Yeah.
Very cool. So, and David, I'm sorry, I didn't realize that you're also an opera singer in addition
yeah.
to the video work and such.
Yeah.
So this must be just a great challenge to take on.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But it's something that you know, Vita and I have both dreamed about doing for a long time
mm-hmm.
because I've been singing for a bit over a decade professionally, and I've sung. I'm on 60 something roles now.
Mm-hmm.
64, 65, something like that. And so I've gotten to sing a huge, huge variety of roles, and I've gotten to work with some amazing directors throughout the years and designers and such. And
so, with this particular production, what should we be looking for that you two have brought to it?
So I think the thing that's unique about this, and it really is new territory, mm-hmm. Certainly for us, but I think it's new territory for the opera world in general, as directors and designers. So we're handling the costume design, set design, video design, projection design, mm-hmm. And the stage direction. We have built this entire production from the ground up based on our directorial ideas all of the design. We designed the set to fit the stage action, as opposed to
and the video projections. Yeah. So it's all very integrated.
It's all completely integrated, and our point of departure from the whole thing was asking the big questions of what is this opera about?
Yeah,
and that's the storytelling that Kevin talked about earlier.
Sure.
Because we absolutely think that it's the most important point of departure is storytelling, and everything works towards that.
Yeah, so we've gotten to work in a very, very integrated way from the storytelling, and the big statement of this opera is to show the fragility of human consciousness, of how we have, you know, we have a skull full of jelly with all of these, you know, electrically connected neurons and synapses, and if one little thing goes wrong in there, our perception, our values, everything about how we see the world and operate in it can change completely. And it's important for us as a society to understand this. And it also shows a portrait of caretaking and dealing with illness and this sort of collision between the traditional approach of modern medicine, which is very cold and clinical, and the actual humanity that it's treating. And this has been a big mission of Dr. Sack's life and work. And so these are the things we want to show. So our point of departure was to start with how does the protagonist in this show see things?
Mm-hmm.
How...
Now, that was the question I was sort of starting with. I mean, you can't help but imagine
absolutely
what it's like to see things through his eyes.
Yeah. And that's what we're out to show as best as we can. So the very first thing we did was get in touch with a neurologist who I knew through one of the opera companies I was working with. And then he brought us into contact with his entire team of neurologists. And we spoke with, as we were going through the whole design and direction process, especially in the early stages, we were in very, very close contact with them. And this is in addition to like all of the research we could possibly fit into the time period we had. And so the set design, you could almost say it was designed by a neurologist, you know, but the set design, the video, everything about the show visually has been crafted based on the information we've gotten from,
I can't wait to see this. I mean, it just sounds like it's going to be so interesting. And Kevin, I mean, opera in many ways is the original multimedia art.
Absolutely.
And this is like taking it to a whole new level in some ways.
It is. And what I think is really exciting about what we're doing here in this production, historically, when a producer like me decides that we're going to do an opera, we might start with a singer that we want to showcase in a role, or we might start with a stage director and say, you know, we think this piece would be good for this director. And then we rely on that one element to then say, okay, if I'm going to hire a stage director, okay, now stage director, you go and recommend to me the designer you want to work with. And then you recommend with me the lighting designer. And the piece kind of comes together in fits and spurts that way.
Mm-hmm.
By having this opportunity to work with Vita and David, what we're able to do is we are really able, under this umbrella, to put together a production that is fully integrated. So if we've done our job correctly, when the audience comes in and sits down, what they're experiencing is not, here's a singer standing in front of some scenery in which there's some light on, and oh, by the way, we're going to throw some video on stage.
Yeah.
This is all very carefully scripted out, and it's almost very cinematic in a way, but it's like live cinema.
That sounds very cool.
And you put the orchestra under that and the commentary that's going on with Matt Kramer, who is the new music director for the ICO that I'm thrilled to be, you know, collaborating with right out of the gate. I hope I haven't made the ICO a little jealous that we get in before the main season. But you know, this integrating experience is something that I think the audience in the Schrott will walk away going, wow. I've never seen anything like this in my life.
And I would love to just keep talking all afternoon with the three of you and learn more about your work, because it sounds just absolutely fascinating. But I will encourage people to check out Glimmer, and it's spelled actually G-L-M-M-R. Before we wrap things up, Kevin, I do want to ask you one question. I haven't asked you at all about the music. What's the music like for this show?
So the composer of this opera is Michael Nyman, and to give people sort of a point of departure, I don't know, back in the mid-90s, Michael Nyman wrote a score for a film called The Piano. Mm-hmm. It starred Sally Fields. I believe she got an Oscar for it. I think it won 7 or 8 Oscars.
Sure.
It's a fabulous film. Well, Michael Nyman wrote the film score for this, and Nyman is at one point a minimalist, though not strictly minimal. At one point, he is almost like a rock and roll sampler, in that he's sampling bits of classical music. You can find rhythm and blues elements. You can find jazz elements. There's a little bit of rock progression in it. But it is in such a disarming musical language that one sits there and it is as tuneful as a Puccini opera would be.
That sounds great.
It's got a lyricism to it that is very, very comfortable for an audience and comfortable for the ears. So, again, for contemporary opera, people think, oh, contemporary opera, oh, must be ugly. No, this is one of the most beautiful scores.
Excellent.
That you'll hear coming from an orchestra of about a dozen pieces.
Perfect. Well, Kevin, David, Vita, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. I can't wait to see The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Thank you all for coming into Art of the Matter today.
Thank you for having us.
Travis DiNicola with the Indianapolis Opera's General Director Kevin Patterson, as well as stage directors Vita Tsikun and David Adam Moore of the New York-based art collective Glimmer. The Indianapolis Opera's production of The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat takes place August 21st through the 23rd at the Schrott Center for the Arts. For more information, visit indieopera.org, indieopera.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. I'll talk with Gary Gensling of the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra and with Joel Harrison of the American Pianists Association about a collaboration that brings Garrick Olson to town.
I'll find out about a skate park being created at the State Museum.
That's a skate park, not a state park, right?
Right.
Okay. And I'll talk with John Alvarado about the Guitar Society of Indianapolis's new season. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.